Hi guys, it's Dr. Sadaf, and I would love for you to like and share this podcast and make sure you leave me a review. I'd love those 5 stars. So please, when you send me a review, please make sure to put the 5 stars in and to share the episode with somebody that you know that could really use it. And I would absolutely appreciate it. Also, if you're looking to schedule an appointment with me, make sure you go to my email and put your name on the email list. You will be the first to know when I open up my office in spring of 2024. It's drsadaf.com. And last but definitely not the least, September 16th to the 23rd, 2024, I will be hosting a retreat with Dr. Basma Ferris in Morocco. You will be getting yoga and coaching, and we'll be doing excursions and cooking and spa and hammam and all of that great stuff along with meditation. So make sure you don't miss out. Spots are limited. So go to the link in my bio in both Instagram and TikTok to make sure you register. Enjoy the show. I am an American board certified OBGYN, a mom, a Muslim, and I'm talking about sex. This is the Muslim Sex Podcast. Welcome to the Muslim Sex Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Sadaf Lodi, and this episode is everything you need to know about mindfulness and being intimate with your partner and how important that is. Before I get into it, the first thing I want to make very clear is that I am not giving any type of medical or religious advice. So if you're having any questions about your health, please see your healthcare provider. And if you have any questions at all about your religion, please speak with your friendly neighborhood religious leader. This is the Muslim Sex Podcast because I just happen to be a Muslim woman that talks about sex. So today I am super, super excited to have on with me the Dr. Lori Brado. And Dr. Brado, I'd love for you to introduce yourself to the audience and to the viewers today.
Yeah. So my name is Lori Brado, and I'm a professor at the University of British Columbia, which is on the west coast of Canada in beautiful Vancouver. I'm also a registered psychologist specializing in sexual health.
All right. Awesome. Yes. And so for those people that don't know, or may perhaps are just tuning in today for the first episode, I reference Dr. Brado all the time on this podcast. I talk about her work and mindfulness, and we talk about sensate focus and how that relates to mindfulness. And also we talk about the research that you've done on mindfulness and how that increases lubrication, arousal, and desire in women that are experiencing decreased libido. So I'd love for you to kind of delve into some of those topics with us today.
Sure. Yeah. So let's start with a definition of mindfulness. And, you know, we when we think of meditation, many of us understand what that is. We think, you know, Buddhist person in lotus pose, many, many hours focusing on the breath. It's been in existence for 3,000 to 4,000 years. And mindfulness is a secular adaptation of that. So it doesn't require any particular religious experience or affiliation. The language is quite simplified with instructions as simple as pay attention to the breath non-judgmentally, return the mind to the here and now when the mind gets lost in distractions or judgmental thoughts. And there's been a lot of research and a lot of interest in the utility of mindfulness for a variety of different health issues, from anxiety to depression to attention concerns, et cetera. And I've been fascinated with the application of mindfulness in the domain of sexual problems, mostly in women, although not only. And it's been the focus of my research for the last 2 decades.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. I know that you are also on television. So tell me a little bit about that.
I mean, I love translating sexual health research findings to the public. And so any opportunity that I have to share those findings in an accessible way, I'm quick to say yes. So I was really lucky 2 years ago to be featured in a 3-episode docuseries on Netflix called The Principles of Pleasure, and where I spoke largely about the science of mindfulness, even got to do a mindfulness practice that shows up in one of the episodes. And it's a lovely, lovely 3-part series that really is about sexual pleasure. What is pleasure? Demystifying it and really empowering the viewer to access and find their own pleasure.
I love that. You know, I know that a lot of times when we talk about sexual health, you know, we often talk, we pathologize it. You know, we talk about infections, we talk about, you know, not getting pregnant. And of course, unfortunately, sometimes we know that there's sexual violence, but, you know, we don't often talk about pleasure. And it's only recently, I feel like, that you hear a lot more about pleasure. And we know that the WHO has also defined sexual health as pleasure being a part of that definition. So I think that it's really, really important that we also focus on that. And so can you maybe talk a little bit more about how focusing on mindfulness increases pleasure?
Yeah, great question. And I love that the World Health Organization actually issued a declaration on the rights to sexual pleasure, which I think is amazing, because one of the things with pleasure is, you know, it doesn't require a partner. It doesn't require any particular relationship fit configuration or intercourse frequency, et cetera. So I love that in general, we're seeing more discussions about sexual pleasure as maybe being the most important part of the sexual experience. And we know when sex doesn't feel pleasurable, that people are less motivated for it. When it feels good, people are more motivated for it. So the link between mindfulness and pleasure, now to be clear, we've mostly been measuring things like genital pain, sexual desire, sexual distress, and then lots of other facets of quality of life like rumination, anxiety, depression, relationship satisfaction, and things like that. But routinely, when we are running mindfulness groups, and I love to run our program in group form, because then the group attendees can learn from one another, they can feel validated from one another, and very often when they talk about their experience, it's the language of pleasure. So paying attention in the present moment, noticing sensations, not being somewhere else, allows them to access pleasure in a way that perhaps they weren't when their body was just going through the motions and their mind was somewhere else. So I truly believe that mindfulness is probably one of the most important ingredients for experiencing sexual pleasure, because of course, if your mind is not present and in sync and in tune, you're not going to feel those great sensations.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, there's so much there that I'd love to delve in more into. I'd love to hear what your take is on sensate focus and mindfulness, because I actually had the pleasure of also having Linda Weiner on my podcast most recently. And she was talking about how she's talked a little bit with you and your mindfulness and how she loves your work and really admires it. And the one thing that I took away from, you know, sensate focus and how it's just a little bit different than mindfulness is that sensate focus tends to focus on one sense. Is that correct? Most on like pressure and touch and texture, more than say mindfulness, which incorporates all of the senses. I'm not sure if I have that correct.
Yeah, I mean, the instructions, first of all, I love what Linda Weiner and Constance Avery Clark have done. They've brought sensate focus out of the 1960s Masters and Johnson tome of a book and really contemporized it and brought it to the world. And I love their manual and all of their writing on this. And they definitely infuse the language of mindfulness throughout in a way that Masters and Johnson actually never used the language of mindfulness, even though I'm pretty convinced that sensate focus is a mindfulness practice. Yes. So the instructions of sensate focus are pay attention as a partner or as the other person is touching you, starting out non-breast, non-genital, et cetera, and really paying attention to whatever it is that arises. And while many therapists might kind of condense the zone of interest to touch, pressure, vibration, a lot of therapists and me and others don't. We say pay attention to whatever comes up, because one of the mechanisms by which mindfulness, by which sensate focus is so powerful, is to teach the person to be in the present in sensations. Because so often, especially in the context of a sexual problem, a person's mind is jumping into the future. Will this hurt? Will I have an orgasm? Will a partner be disappointed? Will I leak urine, right? And so they're not in the present moment. And that is really the power of sensate focus, is in that couple context, teaching them how to be very present, locked in sensation. So I really do believe that sensate focus is a mindfulness practice.
Yes. No, I definitely agree. I think that, right. And that's why I love sensate focus. I think sensate focus is also great when you have couples or individuals that have never been sexual before, and it slowly brings them into the realm of sexuality and just exploring each other and exploring each other's bodies without the pressure of, say, you know, penile-vaginal intercourse, or without the pressure of having an orgasm or whatever, but just really just focusing on the sensations so that they can actually enjoy what's going on without, just as you said, you know, focusing on the future and what's going to happen and, you know, will there be pain? Is this going to hurt? You know, am I going to bleed? What's, you know, all these other things that come about. So I agree with you 100%. Now, when you do the research that you did with the, you know, I think it was those, you did it for 6 months. There were 90-minute sessions. It was a cohort of women that came in for decreased libido. Could you tell us a little bit about that? I know you had also talked about focusing on cognitive behavioral therapy as well, perhaps helping them to change their thoughts. Can you talk a little bit about that?
So the work that you've described was, as we were trying to put together what this mindfulness program would look like. And I was introduced to mindfulness not through sexual health, but through an entirely different stream. I was the University of Washington as a postdoc fellow, and learned about mindfulness actually in the context of dialectical behavior therapy, which is a very different behavioral therapy for individuals who engage in self-harm behavior. And the tenet was, you know, mindfulness is the antidote to disconnecting and tuning out and being afraid of sensations and afraid of your emotions. And I had a light bulb moment, because at the time I was doing research with cancer survivors, mostly gynecologic cancer survivors, who described profound disconnect from their body and a lot of distress and mourning and, you know, loss of motivation. And it was almost as if, yes, they had survived their cancer, but they had kind of died in the face of their sexual health. And so I was doing research with this incredible group of survivors, learning about mindfulness clinically, and just had a moment of, could this be a tool that the survivors might take on? And so the earliest kind of testing of this, as I was learning mindfulness, because it was new to me as well, I, you know, immersed myself in the practice and going to groups and getting a teacher and et cetera. But starting out with one session a month, spread out over 3 months, and it was a slightly longer session, and then got some initial feedback, evaluated it, and over time, we've adapted it. So the version that we've been using for the last 10 plus years is 8 weeks weekly, and each session is 2 hours. And it's mostly mindfulness practice. So we'll dive into an in-depth practice. We'll do an inquiry afterwards, which involves talking about the experience, and then a little bit of psychoeducation after that. Our earliest iterations of the program did involve a little bit of cognitive behavioral therapy in the way of noticing thoughts and recognizing which thoughts were problematic. But within a couple of years, we removed the CBT from mindfulness because it really is quite a different therapeutic approach. CBT, which is a fantastic therapy for helping us address and change difficult thoughts that create problems in our life. But mindfulness is not about changing thoughts. Mindfulness is about recognizing thoughts as mental events. So they're a bit incompatible with each other when it comes to thoughts. So the current iterations of mindfulness don't have any CBT in it. It's, you know, recognize thoughts as something your brain does. In the same way, your gallbladder produces bile, your brain produces thoughts, and you can have that same kind of dispassionate stance towards thoughts as we do to our bile, as an example.
That's fantastic. So I know that in that specific research, you did notice an improvement in lubrication and arousal and libido in women. Is that still the case now? Do you use it for the same situation? Or what are the situations that you use mindfulness under? I guess there's so many that you could, but what are the specific situations that you use it for?
Yeah.
So, pertaining to sexual health.
For sure. So we've now completed many studies using mindfulness as an approach to address sexual problems after cancer. In women, in men, we've done this face-to-face. We've done it online in Zoom. We've built a digital health app for it. And so because I do a lot of work in psychosocial oncology, working with cancer survivors who experience sexual problems, and we know that rates are extremely high, regardless of the kind of cancer or the kind of treatment. So I love mindfulness with that population because it also helps them address other mood and anxiety related issues that may have arisen secondary to their cancer treatment. So definitely with that group. I also use it a lot for low desire. Once we understand kind of what's the root of the person's low desire. So very often people and women in particular will say that they have no desire because they're not enjoying sex. Their mind is elsewhere. They're lost in judgments. They're preoccupied with, you know, other non-sexual related thoughts. And so if that is the case where there are judgments, where there's preoccupations, where there's a lack of a sense of, you know, what feels arousing to me, then I absolutely, you know, mindfulness will be my treatment of choice. And pretty much in any sexual condition where those factors are playing a role in explaining the sexual problem. So even in individuals who have anorgasmia, difficulty reaching orgasm, or a muted orgasm, or extreme delays in reaching orgasm, mindfulness can be really helpful because those individuals will often be focused on the end outcome. Am I going to reach orgasm? Am I there yet? And they're not in the present moment.
Right. I think that's so true. I think that, you know, just focusing on the sensations of what's happening in the moment really brings your whole mind. And actually, I feel like your mind then also brings about like everything, your whole body, because your mind controls all your thoughts and everything. And so it's almost like it's recruiting everything and bringing your attention to that one thing. Right. And
that's exactly it.
And so by doing that, you're really just focused just on that sensation. And I think that probably amplifies that sensation, right? When we focus on a certain sensation or whatever's happening, that it just amplifies it. And then it just probably makes it easier for whatever it is to happen, whether it's orgasm, or I assume you probably also use it in perhaps men that have erectile dysfunction or premature ejaculation when they're not so focused on their performance, right? Or the anxiety of not being able to perform.
Yeah.
If they're just focused on the sensation, that probably helps automatically with, you know, whatever issue they have going on.
It sure does. And we've published a bunch of studies with those populations. So men who have situational erectile dysfunction, which means they have no problems at all with erections when they're on their own. But as soon as they're with a partner, and they start worrying about a partner's evaluation of them, they start hyper focusing on how's my erection, how is this going, and then therefore they lose their erection or they have trouble getting it to begin with. And so we published a couple of studies in that population of men. Clinically, I use it all the time in those men with premature ejaculation, where anxiety is often part of the root cause, as you say, because they're so hyper focused on the outcome that it kind of backfires and leads them to ejaculate before they wish. And then we've also done a couple of studies actually with prostate cancer survivors, where we know that the rates of erectile dysfunction are very, very high after treatment for prostate cancer. And yet many of the approved and easily accessible medications simply don't work for these individuals. And so in that context, mindfulness was about compassion training them to pay attention to sensations that were pleasurable, even in the absence of an erection. So it wasn't about restoring erections. Mindfulness is not going to do that after prostate cancer treatment, but we could introduce them to other ways of being sexual. And it was an extremely powerful effect that we saw in that study.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, I think that, you know, oftentimes people feel that there's something wrong with them, right? Especially after cancer, and that, you know, that they're broken, that they just can't enjoy intimacy anymore. And I think that when you bring mindfulness to the situation, then you know that it's not about the end result, but it's more about the pleasure. It's about the sensation, and it's about how you feel. And I think that just focusing on pleasure and sensations, I think automatically will then lead to, you know, if they're able to have an erection or if they're able to, you know, become aroused, I think automatically that'll happen. You know, I'm really curious about your work with cancer patients, because I know that for women that have breast cancer, and I have a friend who had breast cancer and, you know, ended up having a mastectomy, and then later on had an oophorectomy, had her ovaries removed as well because of the BRCA gene and things like that. That then after that, I mean, intimacy was just not even, you know, a part of what she was thinking about. It was so hard for her because of the arousal issues, but also lubrication. And then she had issues being put on hormones and all of this. And so I'm curious about what you've noted in cancer patients and also with body image. I think that there's, you know, a lot of issues there.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up breast cancer, because you know, breast cancer is an area where we've seen a lot of advances in treatment over time. And so, you know, a survivor's chance of surviving today is far higher than it was 20 or 40 years ago. And that's wonderful and amazing. And it also means that we have an increasing proportion of people who have changes to their quality of life and sexual health that they're living with for many, many years. And because breast cancer, you know, impacts women in their 40s and 50s, that means that they're potentially living with side effects for a long time, for many decades. And so, you know, for all of the reasons that you've described, whether it was the ovaries that were removed or chemotherapy or a mastectomy that changed body image, or fear of cancer recurrence, which is a very significant and sometimes debilitating anxiety that a lot of survivors will experience often right at that 5-year mark. And it's usually when they're no longer, at least in Canada, our cancer care centers usually stop after about 5 years of frequent surveillance. And so you see a spike in anxiety when they're no longer being followed so closely by their doctors. So lots of different ways in which cancer, the diagnosis, and then cancer treatment can impact sexual health. You know, for some of those women, taking an estrogen is not safe for them. Not all of them, but for some of them. And this is where an individual conversation with, you know, a qualified gynecologist, sexual medicine physician is really, really important. But definitely for some of them, taking an estrogen would not be safe for them. So on a psychological level, we absolutely want to be addressing things like body image. So what happens during sexual activity is this person now avoiding undressing with the lights on? Are they avoiding any kind of touching to the body that in the past used to be arousing and enjoyable for them? Is there pain right around radiation scars, et cetera? Sensations can feel very, very different after cancer treatment. So learning how to experience pleasurable touch again, and then communication. So if this is a person in a relationship where sex used to come quite easily, quote, naturally, and one didn't have to talk about what felt good and what hurt, this can be quite new to actually talk to a partner about what are some changes that they may want to make. So oftentimes, I will recommend to survivors work with a qualified sexual health expert, you know, doctor, therapist, et cetera, because this is an important part of your quality of life. And we have great evidence-based tools to help you navigate this.
Right. No, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I think that a lot of that also has to do perhaps with the feeling of loneliness, you know? And so I'm wondering how you incorporate that in your group therapy. Do you usually do group therapy with your cancer survivors, or are they individual? Are they one-on-one? What does your institution do?
Yeah. So in our research studies, it's been almost exclusively in group format. Pre-pandemic, it was all in person. You know, people would have to come to our center and find the room and pay for parking, what have you. And then post-pandemic, when a lot of people switch to telehealth or online video technologies, et cetera, we've moved almost exclusively to online, which means that it helps us overcome some of those geographic barriers that prevent, and financial barriers that prevent people from coming to a center. I love doing this in group format because, you know, for a lot of these people, you mentioned loneliness, they're suffering in silence. They're too embarrassed to tell even their closest friends that they're struggling in this domain. So suddenly to be in a group with other women who get it, where you don't feel so alone, where you don't have to explain yourself and you can just sort of show up as yourself. That we call it the group magic. And it's pretty therapeutic. We've actually evaluated, you know, when we just bring them to group and just give them a little bit of psychoeducation and nothing else, just the group environment, a little bit of information about what does the research say about sexual health. Guess what? They start to improve because they're in that welcoming, validating environment where they don't feel broken.
Right. And I think there is so much, like what you said, magic to community. I think that we as humans, I think we search out communities. And when we can find communities where, you know, people relate to us, we don't always have to explain ourselves, people just get it, then I think you automatically have that sense of belonging. And I think that applies to whether it's like a menopause community or sexual coaching or intimacy or mindfulness. I feel that that really helps with a lot of women.
Yeah, it sure does. None of us want to be alone.
Yeah, that's for sure. I'm wondering, so Rosemary Basson, is she with at your university as well?
Yeah, she's recently retired. Okay. But I did some of my training with her when I was a graduate student. Wow. And then I left for 3 years, went to the University of Washington, and then came back to University of British Columbia as a faculty member. And Rosemary and I became very, very good colleagues for, you know, we remain excellent colleagues to this day. So we've published quite a few papers together and have done a lot of good work together.
That's fantastic. So, you know, I reference actually both of your research, both yours and Rosemary Basson's. And I think she was the one that did the libido research with you, right? She and you did that research together?
Yeah. We've done a lot of work looking at, you know, predictors of desire, what's the role of testosterone in desire, impact of DHEA and stress hormones on desire. And Rosemary, of course, is credited for reconceptualizing the sexual response cycle into a circular model, one that recognizes that for a lot of women, they don't start out with spontaneous desire. They might start out with good reasons or interest in sex, but not necessarily feeling desire. And so really normalized that phenomenon for a lot of women, that you know, that arousal can be the instigator of desire rather than the other way around.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was just going to ask you about that. You know, that's fantastic that it's a perfect segue into what I was going to ask you about the female sexual response cycle and how it's circular and how she talks about responsive and spontaneous desire and the different things that can affect those things and whether or not a woman is responsive to that stimuli can be affected by the biopsychosocial model, you know, depending on what's going on with her biologically, you know, if she has medications that are affecting her desire, if there's, you know, maybe she's on antidepressants, maybe she's on birth control pills, right? We know that those can affect desire as well, or she has something going on socially in her community, or maybe she's a single mom and, you know, sex is just another chore. You know, there's so many things. And then how, as, you know, that sexual response, that arousal can come after desire or vice versa, that there's no real, you know, linear pattern that Masters and Johnson was saying, but rather it's more circular. And the more emotionally satisfied a person is in their relationship will determine how responsive they are to the sexual stimuli that they have. So I'm wondering where, you know, you see that mindfulness in that component, in that sexual response falls in.
Yeah, everywhere. I mean, basically, so if we look at kind of what's the starting point in that circular sexual response cycle, it is, and let's talk about a woman right now, although, you know, it's not specific to women, but we'll think of a woman right now who may be feeling neutral, sexually neutral, but somewhat open and open to sexual activity, either with her initiating or being responsive to a partner's advances. And so the reasons for sex, which has been a whole other field of a lot of research looking at why do people have sex? What are their motivations for sex? Having good reasons that are what we call approach related. So it's to get something good as opposed to avoid something bad. Mindfulness is really important there because it's not something we often think about. You know I ask my clients all the time, why do you have sex? And they kind of look at me a little bit like deer in headlights, like, well, I don't know. Why do people have sex? I just do it. So mindfulness is an opportunity to pause, look inwards, and actually connect with sensations in that moment of motivation that might point to what your individual reasons are. So that's one place where mindfulness is really important in that circular sexual response cycle. Another place is further along down the cycle as the woman is receiving or using stimuli or triggers that work for her. So these are the things that elicit arousal for her. Is it a particular touch? Is it a sound? Is it a smell? Is it watching erotica? Is it having a fantasy? And mindfulness is also really critical there because let's say she's engaging with a vibrator because vibrators is one of her modes of feeling arousal, but her mind is thinking about an interaction with a boss. That vibrator is not going to get very far if her brain is wrapped up in a different scenario. So mindfulness is also really important there. And then further along down the sexual response cycle, the brain takes all of that information. It takes the reasons and motivations. It takes responsivity to triggers and the context and then makes a decision about whether to produce arousal or not. And that's also a place where inattention and other brain-related barriers can shut off the sexual response cycle. So lots of different places where mindfulness really hangs itself nicely on that sexual response cycle. And then, of course, the outcome. You know, there's been some other writing by my colleague Amy Muse out of Toronto that suggests that after couples have sex, they should hold each other for 7 minutes because those 7 minutes are really important for some of the oxytocin and other hormonal changes that happen, the kind of bonding hormones that makes sex rewarding. And so if people kind of get up right away and wash themselves and go off, you're kind of not benefiting from those hormonal changes together with a partner. So that's also a place where we want to make sure that we are practicing mindfulness. What are the kind of post-sexual arousal sensations feel like, et cetera. So I think those two approaches, the circular sexual response cycle and mindfulness, really align quite nicely.
I love it. Thank you so much for going over all of that. I just love all the different ways that mindfulness interacts with the sexual response cycle and how it really just goes hand in hand. And it's so important to know that and understand that. And I think that as I'm a sex counselor as well as a sex coach and an Ishwish fellow and all that stuff. So I think that that's so important when practitioners are talking to their patients and talking about all the different ways that mindfulness can really impact their relationship and really benefit it, especially for women that are really experiencing decreased libido. And, we know that as they call female sexual dysfunction, there's so many in all of those realms with pain, with intercourse, with anorgasmia, with, decreased libido, all of those things can really benefit with mindfulness. I think that what you have written about is so, so meaningful and has so much value. And I think that if people, if more people understood it and realized it, I think that we could really help a lot of dysfunction. And I know that, I'm not being naive and knowing that sometimes dysfunction has to do with anatomical causes as well. But I think that when women go so long with dysfunction, with pain, with intercourse, or in fact, there was just a post that I read the other day about a woman that has been newly married, experiencing vaginismus, and so bad to the point that, she's a physician, she knows how to use these dilators, she knows how to do everything, but, that cognitive part of it is not there. So she's taking care of all of these anatomical things that she thinks are going to help. But she doesn't realize that her brain has so much control over what she sees and what she feels and the fear now that she anticipates every time. And she's not able to, consummate her wedding, and it's causing so much problem. And now she's thinking about a divorce. And it's just, so many things that are all related to not only just the anatomical part of the dysfunction, but also the cognitive part of it, which I think, mindfulness so nicely addresses.
Very common scenario, the one that you've described. And, often those women will go home and they'll try the vaginal inserts, and they're reading the instructions, and the phobia, the fear, the trauma in some cases is so strong that they just feel immobilized.
Yes. And that's exactly what's happening in that scenario. So, I think it's really important for patients and for anyone that's listening to really, perhaps read your book that you have, Better Sex Through Mindfulness, and or also, work with a sex therapist. I think that there's so much value in that. And especially when you have perhaps a history of trauma or abuse or it's something such as that, really important to kind of unpack all that baggage so that you can move forward, because it's hard to move forward when you have so many things that you're worried about in your head and you're just not able to move past that.
Yeah, exactly.
So for everyone that is listening and watching and is thinking, wow, Lori is amazing, and I just to get in touch with her and learn more and watch everything that she's put out there, how can they get in touch with you? How can they watch what you've put out? I know you're on social media, and I know that you have books published and you have so much research. How can they get information from all the things that you've written?
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for that opportunity. You mentioned the Netflix series, The Principles of Pleasure. It's a fantastic 3-episode series. There are other scientists that are also featured in the piece, and it's really accessible. It's chock full of stories of women and gender diverse people experiencing pleasure. So I often point people there. If you want to follow me on social media, it's just at Dr. Lori Brado. And all of our research studies, we also have a research social media handle, which is at UBCSHR. So that's University of British Columbia Sexual Health Research. And there we post links to the studies that we're doing, especially if we're recruiting people, et cetera. And then, of course, the books, there's Better Sex Through Mindfulness, which really is a kind of a synthesis of the science of mindfulness for sexual mm-hmm. health and pleasure. And then more recently, the Better Sex Through Mindfulness workbook, which came out last year. And that walks the reader through all of the exercises that they can do at home on their own or with a qualified sex therapist or mindfulness practitioner.
That's fantastic. Those are amazing resources. And I know that I will be following you on all of your links, but also your book. I'm going to make sure that I get that because I think it's going to be so helpful and so helpful to all the patients that are experiencing, some pain and really need more of a cognitive approach. So mm-hmm. I really appreciate all of the resources that you have out there. So any last pearls that you would like to say to our viewers and listeners out there?
Yeah, maybe one is that it's never too late to make improvements in your sex life. It doesn't matter your age. It doesn't matter if you're in a relationship. It doesn't matter your health status, etc. We do have evidence-based and quite effective approaches like mindfulness to improve sexual health so that you can live a more fulfilling sex life.
Thank you for that hopeful message, because I think that oftentimes is what happens to individuals is that they lose hope.
Yeah.
And they think that it's not going to change for them and things are not going to get better. So I think that message resonates really well. So thank you so much. Thank you for your time. I know you are super busy, so I really appreciate your time. And it's been real and it's been really intimate. And remember, this is not meant to be any type of medical advice. So if you're having any issues with your sexual health, please see your sexual health provider. And until next time, this is the Muslim Sex Podcast. So thank you for listening to the podcast and make sure you leave us a review, share and like the podcast. And if you leave me a review, I'd love to shout you out on social media. So be sure that you share it with all your friends. And thanks for listening.